counsel for the government. The first issue that I would like to address this morning is allocution, the fact that the district court did not give the defendant the right to speak before the sentencing took place. We've set out in our brief several cases from this court, all of which point out that this is a must. All of them refer to the Supreme Court's decision in United States versus Green, where the court says that...
In what way did he not give the defendant the right to speak? He invited him to speak, and he chose not to. He chose to present something through his lawyer.
I do not think...
What's the problem?
He did not address him, Judge. He did not say to him, Mr. Noel, do you have anything to say? Every case that this court has decided, that they have spoken of that.
So you think the problem is he addressed his lawyer and said, does your client have anything to say, that was the problem?
That's exactly what happened, Judge.
Yeah, but what's wrong with that?
He must address the defendant personally. He must, according to Green, must be unambiguous and must be clear-cut that he addresses the defendant personally. The rule says that also.
Well, isn't the point of the rule to make the defendant aware of his right to speak? And so if that's the case, then the court's statements were enough to apprise him of that right?
It's very nice in this environment for us to look at it that way, but this is a man that was facing a huge term in jail. He's in a place that he's not familiar with. He doesn't know the rules of the game.
That's why he has a lawyer, right? And his lawyer not only surely advised him of this, he heard the judge talk to his lawyer, and he had prepared a written statement, which was presented.
No, he, Judge...
The idea
did
that...
Did not read in...
Counsel, trying to speak over the court doesn't help. The idea
sure.
That a defendant represented by a lawyer who actually made a statement to the court through this written statement doesn't know he can make a statement to the court seems to me quite implausible, and if true, would be a ground for disbarring the lawyer. But you're not suggesting that his lawyer should be disbarred.
I don't think that her representation here measured up to what I would expect were I the client. But that's beside the point. The fact is that all the cases in this court and the Supreme Court have said that the burden is on the court to make the situation unambiguous. In a decision, Barnes, by Judge Flom in this court, he suggests that the burden should also be shared by the government, and the government could easily speak up and say to the court, excuse me, Your Honor, but the defendant should be given a right to speak for himself. And those cases are crystal clear in that respect. I certainly think that the lawyer should have spoke up. I think that the government should have spoke up. The least one that we can expect it of is the defendant. We don't know what was going on in his mind. He wrote this letter, addressed it to the judge, but gave it to the probation officer, who didn't even see, gave it to his lawyer, who neither gave it to the probation officer or sent it to the court, and read it more or less as an afterthought.
So
that letter wasn't included in the PSR?
It was not.
I'm completely lost. That's exactly what allocution is. It's not presented to the probation officer. It is read out in open court. That's what happened. The defendant made a statement in open court through the reading of his letter.
And it did not speak, Judge, and that is the point. And the letter doesn't substitute for that.
Was the letter prepared for the probation department or for the reading in the court?
It's unclear. According to the lawyer, she received it, but it was too late to give to the probation officer. And then she says, because of what the prosecutor had said in aggravation, she thought she might read it to the court, that the prosecutor had no objection. But that isn't the defendant speaking. And in Ferrara, there's the case about representing yourself, and in all the cases of elocution, they talk about the defendant speaking, his halting language, his appeal for mercy, his, not the lawyer's. That makes an impression, and the court, the rule says, must address the defendant personally. We may look at it as something formal, something that, well, it wouldn't have changed it anyway, but we don't know that. And the rule is there for a reason, and the cases that this court has decided
well, prior
are clear.
To, prior to the update of Rule 32, which was quite some time ago, this process you wouldn't have any quarrel with, right? Because it would have...
I would have quarrel with
it. Well, you'd have maybe a quarrel with it philosophically and for the reasons you said the defendant should articulate it. But when the revision was made to the rule with the inclusion of the word personally...
Well, the revision was made after Green, as I recall.
Right,
as
it was
recollect.
Made after Green, right.
And... But the right goes all the way back to English common law.
I understand that. Yeah, I understand that you would take the position it wasn't even correct, you know, pre-Green, but certainly since Green and since the rule change.
It's crystal clear to me, but I'm not sitting where you are. So the next that I would address shortly is the sentence itself. When the lawyer finishes reading the letter, the judge goes immediately into the sentencing faction. And the sentences here are completely disproportionate to the mean, to the average, to other cases similar to this one, as best you can draw that using the figures from the Bureau of Prisons and from the United States court system. A Category 6 defendant would receive a sentence of 255 months. This sentence was 960 months. If the judge had not run the sentences consecutive, his sentence would have been approximately 255 months, which would basically be the mean sentence for somebody in a Category 6. He was in a Category 1. This sentence is disproportionate. It can be if the judge gives reasons, but none of the reasons set out in his reasoning would support the sentence of 960 months, in our opinion. The last two issues, one is the opinion of the police officer that the photographs were child pornography. The government says that she was an expert and offered as an expert. She was offered as an expert in computer sciences and not as an expert as to child pornography or what pictures might constitute child pornography.
And but the problem here is the defendant didn't really challenge whether the pictures were child pornography. It appeared that he seemed to concede that during closing argument. So where's the prejudice?
Judge, I saw that argument. That came after the fact. I don't know what the lawyer was doing or what... She didn't seem to have done much, in my opinion, and I hesitate to say that, but that's my opinion.
Because the other problem is that the defense counsel didn't even address whether the pictures fit the definition of child pornography during the cross, and it seems like it was part of a strategy to keep the photos, all those photos, from going to the jury, or do you think defense counsel forgot to bring it
even,
up?
Even if she concedes it, having the police officer testify in the government's case in chief that these pictures were child pornography is wrong. That testimony should not have been admitted. And for them to then come to this court and claim that she was offered as an expert, that she was offered as an expert on child pornography is just plain not fact.
Another thing that troubles me about it is, was there any issue of state pornography or the difference between state pornography and child pornography in the case?
None that I see from the transcript. Originally, I believe he was charged in the state court and the federal court took it over. But
nobody made that argument. It
no.
wasn't a defense that this is state pornography,
no.
not federal.
None. And the last is the dose factors. The instruction using the dose factors is just plain confusing. It adds nothing to the case, and this court, in its opinion, could do everybody a favor by saying that, it would seem to me. Every case that has come up to it has discussed it and, for the most part, been critical of it. It certainly doesn't help. If we're not going to define reasonable doubt for a jury, I don't think that we have to define lascivious. Lascivious is a good English word and conveys a meaning that's known to everybody. If there are no other questions, I'll save some time for rebuttal.
Mr. Nash.
Thank you.
Ms. Hart.
Good Good morning. May it please the Court and Mr. Nash. My name is Gail Hellert, and I have been the prosecutor on this case since its beginning. I will start with Argument 3 made by the defense about Rule 32. In this case, Rule 32 was not violated. Dick Knoll knew he had the right to allocution even before the sentencing date of June 1, 2007. We know he knew because he took the time to write the lengthy letter his counsel read at sentencing, chock full of the factors.
Well, yeah, that's the reason I asked the question. Was it meant to be included in the PSR, or was it to be read?
Defense counsel made a statement just before she read it that indicated she was going to give it to probation, but it was too late, and then she said she would read it to the court.
So it was meant to go on the PSR. At least you can infer that.
I don't know that I would infer that because of the way it starts, Honorable Judge Tinder. The lengthy letter included the mitigating facts outlined in the brief, but included his love for John Doe. His friend had done the acts of producing the pictures and had betrayed him, his clean record, etc. The letter was directed toward the district court personally because it started Honorable Judge Tinder. The letter was personally written by Dick Knoll because he signed it and stated factors in mitigation from his own point of view, not his lawyer's.
It does concern me that he prepared it and then he clearly gave it to the lawyer, and the lawyer for some reason didn't get it in the PSR.
I can't explain that. I don't know, because I don't know what their conversations were prior to that. But it did get read at sentencing. It got read at the appropriate time. It got presented to the court as Dick Knoll wished. And it started out Honorable Judge Tinder. It is difficult to fathom in this case either that Rule 32 was not complied with or that Dick Knoll's substantial rights were violated under a plain error analysis.
But when you look at Rule 32 clearly states that the court must address the defendant personally. And then when you look at Green and you look at the rule change in 32, it contemplates that you ask the individual, and would you like to speak? And that didn't happen here.
Yeah, we have seen that in the case law, and I have cited exactly what the court said, and this court has the record. The court said, and now I'll hear first from the government with respect to its argument regarding sentencing, and then I'll hear from the defense. That distinguishes between defense counsel and Mr. Knoll. The defense is both parties. And, of course, Ms. Jensen, as part of the defense presentation, your client, Mr. Knoll, has the right to speak. That is, to say whatever he wants to say to help me in determining what the sentence should be. Then I made the government's presentation, and then the district court stated, all right, and Ms. Jensen, do you have a presentation you'd like to make regarding sentencing, and would your client like to address me? So Judge Tinder never said, Mr. Knoll, would you like to personally, as a script would be or as the cases suggest. But he did give two opportunities to Dick Knoll, who was personally present in court, meaning that he stated twice.
Well, I guess it depends whether you want to treat the rule literally where it says the judge must address the defendant personally.
Mm-hmm. Well,
none of the comments by Judge Tinder were directed to the defendant. They were directed to his counsel.
Well, Judge Tinder did state twice that Mr. Knoll had the right to speak at sentencing.
I know what he said. Mm-hmm. He didn't address the defendant.
And, well, Dick Knoll, though, did speak through this letter. And the fact that this lengthy letter existed and that it was read at sentencing after the second time that Ms. Jensen and Dick Knoll were told they had the right to do so definitively distinguishes this case from any case cited by the parties in their briefs. The cases cited by the parties all have defendants who did not allocute at all. Here, Dick Knoll did allocute, and he did so through this carefully thought-out written letter that began with Honorable Judge Tinder. Judge Tinder never interrupted the reading of the letter, never said anything throughout the reading of the letter like, that's enough, or I've heard enough. The
and
letter
never
was
said to Mr. Knoll, is there anything else, Mr. Knoll, you wish the court to take into account?
There is one case that has addressed that.
I'm saying he never said that after
no,
the letter
No, that's correct.
Was read.
He never did say that. No, because Ms. Jensen went right into her presentation, and then the court went into its sentencing.
And you felt you didn't have to remind the judge about allocution?
You know, I was thinking about the government's presentation. I had just sat down, that had happened, and I did not think about it.
So I take it then you don't take a checklist with you when you go to sentencing to make sure the judge hits everything.
You know,
this would have been so simple.
That is true. And I hear the judges do a very careful script. Judge Tinder does a very careful script, and I believe he was being very careful and he was being very respectful addressing Ms. Jensen, and I believe he did think that he hit the rule. I believe that. And
right,
I don't believe
but I was asking about you. There should be something
correct.
As a prosecutor, you should
yes.
have something there to hit it, because this case wouldn't even, at least this issue wouldn't
this
even
issue.
Be here if at the end you had said, and Judge, will you ask Mr. Knoll if he has anything to say?
And that is true, and even if I would have had a list, I might have looked at that and thought, oh, there was no personal addressing. But after such a lengthy letter, I might have passed it on by as well. But I did not have a checklist with me. That is true. The letter was read, though, after the invitation to speak. And importantly, it was read prior to the sentencing court announcing its sentencing. Judge Tinder, in our view, even verified that this was allocution, because he stated, "You're reading the letter that Mr. Knoll wrote," and his lawyer said yes. But even if this court finds that Rule 32 was not complied with, this court has two precedent cases from 2007, that is Lupke and Petrie, which support the conclusion that remand is not required. In Petrie, this court stated that the general rule did not foreclose the possibility that the facts of a particular case may compel a conclusion that a violation of the defendant's right to allocution did not affect seriously the fairness of the judicial proceedings. And in Lupke, this court recognized the core values needing to be upheld at sentencing of fairness, of integrity, of public reputation of the judicial proceedings, but acknowledged that an indication on the face of the record, although rare, might show that a denial of the right did not implicate these core values of sentencing. Here, the face of the record is clear that the core values of a sentencing were upheld. Dick Knoll did allocute through his carefully thought out and detailed letter containing potentially numerous mitigating facts. The letter was genuinely considered by the court. The letter was read prior to the court pronouncing its sentence. It is difficult to imagine any other subject that Mr. Knoll could have covered, even had he been asked, "Mr. Knoll, would you like to say anything to the court?"
Unless he decided that he would actually accept responsibility. If he took responsibility, he could have taken responsibility for his actions at the hearing.
One could presume that the letter thought he was, because he said, "I am apologizing even though I don't think I have
well,
to."
Well, yeah, the whole tone of the letter was that he didn't do it. I mean, it's the same defense that his counsel presented at trial.
I'm not.
It's his mysterious friend that did it.
That's correct. And I'm not going to presume that his allocution would have been better. And I'm not saying his allocution, in our view, was very good in the sense that he did blame it on another person and didn't take responsibility. But just because that it was so well thought out and so detailed that it is hard to imagine that he would have had a change of heart given his consistent defense at the sentencing being the same as the allocution, the letter that was read, that he would have said anything different.
Can you move to this opinion testimony? Because I didn't understand why Barnes was called to testify as to whether or not the photos met the federal definition of child pornography versus state pornography. That wasn't even in the game. I mean, the jury didn't even know that he was arrested on state charges.
That is true.
So I don't even understand why that was necessary. And isn't it the jury's role to look at the photos and determine if it's child pornography? Why did the officer have to tell them?
It is absolutely the jury's role to be the fact finder and look at the pictures. The government intended for Detective Barnes to be an expert, and I cannot imagine now standing before you trying to argue she was a lay opinion witness, as Mr. Knoll contended in his brief. As an expert witness, though, she was entitled to opine about the content of the images, especially since she conducted the forensic examination and she knew what fit under the definition of illegal under federal law.
And basically she just said the pictures met the definition of child pornography. Isn't that a legal conclusion? I mean, she didn't go into, say, the DOS factors or provide, you know, testimony that related to the DOS factors so then the jury could make that conclusion themselves. She just said it met the federal standards with no explanation. Right.
And the idea behind...
Several times.
Right. And defense counsel pointed out probably six times that I asked that question. The idea behind those questions was to illustrate to the jury that she had noted specific things as, or significant and specific things as she had gone through the examination of the computer. Obviously, if all she had seen was adult material or child erotica, we would not have been at the trial. The jury had to know that there was a difference between nude pictures of children and then nude illegal pictures of children. And the jury had to know that we knew the difference between that, too, that we weren't trying to get the pictures of John Doe's bare buttocks to be illegal. That wasn't what was charged. The John Doe
pictures...
So
maybe I did that, because I didn't read her entire testimony. But so didn't she... She did not say, though, the way that one makes a determination as to whether or not it's pornography or not is to look at these factors. Or
no.
As I examine these photographs, here are the things. As a trained expert, this is my job. And as an expert, what I'm trained to do is identify what might meet the definition and what doesn't. Here are the things that don't. Here are the things that do. And based on that... I mean, she didn't do that. She just said it met the definition.
She did not do that. She did not put them within the DOST factor analysis. She didn't do that at all. I wouldn't have had her do that in our preparation, and I was simply trying to show the jury that she distinguished between what was lawful and what was unlawful in the computer analysis that she was doing.
So basically she was just telling them that it was... These were illegal photos, that it was unlawful.
Well, she had noted...
That was her legal conclusion.
She had noted significant pictures, and yes, that they were unlawful under federal law, but we don't believe that that commented improperly as would be prohibited on Mr. Knoll's state of mind, Mr. Knoll's intent, or even the other ultimate issue in the case, which is who did it.
And... even why it's relevant.
Mm-hmm.
Put to one side the question that this appears to be expert testimony on a question of law, mm-hmm. and without going through the Daubert and Rule 702 qualification process, we have had a spate of cases recently in which assistant U.S. attorneys have tried to put before the jury what amounts to a lot of hearsay, quite damning, by saying, now here's how I conduct my investigation. Right, and they all take the form, I only investigate guilty people. And then we get explanations about why the defendant is a guilty person, where if the testimony had been made directly, it would be either irrelevant or hearsay or other crime evidence or one of those things. And I don't know why you and other assistant U.S. attorneys think it's proper if done as an explanation of why I'm investigating. It still has all those problems.
Well, I hear what you're saying about those. I don't know that...
We've started reversing some of those mm-hmm. cases. That's what happened in the Campbell case. We've had difficulty after Campbell deciding when this kind of thing is harmless error. Now, here, since there was no objection, the plain error doctrine gives you a lot of protection. But if there had been an objection, this would have been really troublesome.
Well, and the court also... There was no objection. It wasn't consistent with the defense that Mr. Knoll was putting on. And the court gave the proper expert opinion instruction saying that the jury, the appropriate instruction that the jury was not required to accept her opinion even if she had special knowledge or skill. And truly the point of those questions were that we had so much material that I just simply wanted the jury to know we had distinguished between the legal and illegal pictures.
And I still don't see what the relevance is that you had made that distinction.
Just the volume of pictures.
But that was the point I was trying to make.
Right.
How some agent investigates
right.
is not relevant to the defendant's guilt or innocence.
Mm-hmm.
It is a means of smuggling in damning testimony, but it's not relevant. Whether it's guilty or innocent depends on the proof that's offered in the case and not the details of the investigation.
So then all you do is you put together a book of the photos pre-trial that you think meet the DOS factors. Those are given to the jury, and they review it. Or she testifies and says, I've looked at these, and in each of these photos, children are depicted in X way. I mean, that's a fact. I mean, she... It wouldn't be problematic in my mind if she had said, and especially if there's no objection, and I assume the defense wouldn't want the jury to have to go through 1,000 photos because that would be damning. That's why the defense was silent. And so I agree with Judge Easterbrook. We're in plain error land. But the point is, she could say, for summary purposes, I've looked at these, and each of these photos I've looked at were not a situation where it was just a nude child. You know, these were settings where the children were posed in this way, or this was showing, or this was showing. I mean, that would be at least describing what was in there, even though there could be an objection to that. But that gets closer to at least putting something before the jury for them to decide. You just basically gave them the whole conclusion. And it doesn't matter how she sat down and separated. What you should have offered at trial is just what fell into that category. It wasn't necessary for you to say it's illegal, and therefore that's why we're offering these photos. You just give the jury the photos that qualify.
In this case, and I see
and I understand we're in a computer, but right. I mean you the computer was preserved. I mean these photos were preserved, weren't they? Right, and they could have been reproduced.
And if I could respond, but I see my time is up, but if I could respond to that, a couple of the way that these pictures got presented to the jury, and there are different ways in different cases, we had 246 pictures of John Doe. 10 of them we alleged were illegal, but the rest were shown to the jury. And in my experience through grand jury work and through trial work and the times that we're able to talk to citizens, these pictures are really quite offensive. And juries don't understand why all nude pictures of children are not deemed illegal, but they're not. And so if it's a bad attempt, it was simply my attempt to distinguish to the jury that we know the difference between legal and illegal, that we weren't trying to get every one of the 246 pictures in front of them as illegal.
But my point is, why do they even have to know there are 246 pictures?
We wanted them to know that, and that was one of our pretrial rulings, and because he was sexually attracted to John Doe and because it provided a motive for him to take the pictures.
But why do you need to show them? You showed all those many pictures?
Yes. We put a book together.
Why didn't you just show the illegal ones?
The illegal ones were the charged ones, and the 246 ones were partially...
More and more looking like a smear. It's
no.
A good... if objections have been made, they certainly should have been sustained. And I hope you're not planning on doing this again, because if you do this again and objections are made, it's not going to stand up.
Well, in pretrial motions, if I could respond to that, in pretrial motions, there was so much material found at Dick Knoll's house. The subject of pretrial motions were all the books that related to a sexual attraction to children and sex with children, text stories found on his...
I don't need this description.
No, but what I'm
Thank
saying
you,
is... Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Anything further, Mr. Nash?
Very, very short, Judge.
In her presentation... the prosecutor here says it's difficult to imagine what else Mr. Knoll could have said if he had spoken. The point of the rule and the point of the cases from this court and the Supreme Court is that we do not speculate on that. The judge is to address the jury, and in the two cases, both of which were affirmed, cited by the government, Franklin and Williams, that's exactly what happened. The district court addressed the judge personally. Mr. Defendant, do you have anything you wish to add? That did not happen in this case. The letter is not sufficient. The attorney is speaking is not sufficient. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Mr. Nash, we appreciate your willingness to take the appointment in this case and the assistance you provided to your client. The case is taken under advisement.